So there is a global recession that's coming in the next quarter or two, I'm growing more worried about. And that at the same time that central banks are being forced to tighten monetary policy in the teeth of that.
Welcome everyone, Wealthian founder Adam Taggart here. As the Russian invasion into Ukraine continues into its third week, despite the world's hope for resolution, uncertainty continues to grow. What would the geopolitical situation look like after a ceasefire is declared, if one's declared? How badly will the trade disruptions with Russia worsen inflation, given Russia's role as a top exporter for many key commodities? And are we weakening the US dollar's role as the global reserve currency by giving other nations cause to accelerate their efforts to de-dollarize? And meanwhile, the cost of capital is increasing as interest rates are on the rise, right as we anticipate the Federal Reserve is going to kick off a new era of quantitative tightening at its meeting this week. Are a further correction in the markets and possibly a recession now more likely as a result? To help us understand what's likely to emerge from all of this swirling uncertainty, we welcome Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group and editor of The Book Report. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm really sorry to put such a heavy responsibility on your shoulders for your first appearance on this channel.
Well, it's every day I have to make money for clients in the investing world. So it's things that I obsess about every day to try to not get hit by all the left and right jabs that are coming our way.
All right. Well, look, I'm really excited to dive into this with you. I love talking to people like you, Peter, because you don't have the luxury of just having an opinion. You actually have to back it up with trade decisions that affect, you know, real world people like your clients. So I've got a long list of things I want to go through with you, but I'd like to start with a question that I ask all my guests at the beginning. It's a very high level question, which is, what is your current assessment of today's global economy and the financial markets?
Well, I think inflation has single-handedly slowed the behavior of consumer spending, which at least in the US is obviously the biggest component of the economy. We know that we've been thrown a supply chain mess over the past couple of years, and now with the Russian invasion has added more complexity to that situation. So that is in turn also delaying investment decisions, expansion decisions, and just slowing the pace of economic activity. So growth was slowing before the invasion. That growth deceleration will get enhanced by this, particularly in Europe. You take natural gas prices in Europe, which doubled over a short period of time, is actually up, was up, it was $15 per megawatt about a year ago, and then went to 200. So not only affecting the cost of heating one's home, but also causing a lot of strain for industrial facilities that use natural gas as feedstock, and which also creates its own problems to the point where facilities are shutting down until natural gas prices go down. So there is a global recession that's coming in the next quarter or two. I'm growing more worried about. And that at the same time that central banks are being forced to tighten monetary policy in the teeth of that.
All right, great. You're already answering some of the questions that I had on my list to ask you later on. All right, but I heard you correctly. World was already sort of beginning to slow down before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The dramatic increase in a lot of commodity prices, particularly energy, is really adding to that deceleration, such to the point where you feel like we're staring at a recession, and I'm going to say global recession, but you tell me if you think it's only relevant to certain parts of the world, coming in the next quarter or two.
Well, it's global. Well, let's break it down. Europe, I don't think I'm going out on a limb here to say that their economy is going to slow dramatically over the next couple of quarters. And whether there's a minus sign in front of GDP or it's close to zero, it's still going to feel the same. Even if it's 1%, it'll still feel the same. I find it hard to believe that it'll even be positive 1%. Let's take China. We know China's been slowing dramatically with the decline and stress in their residential real estate market, which is about a third of their economy. And then you take the US, where we had a very good fourth quarter of 2021, but a lot of that, or most of that GDP increase was inventory build.
Inventory restocking, yeah.
Of the 7% GDP print, about 500 basis points was inventory restocking. Now, some of that will happen in Q1 still, but overall GDP, at least as forecast, is around the flat line. And then you throw in this reacceleration in the price of a lot of key things like gasoline and food, and you can just imagine the psyche of the American consumer. And it's not just the lower income consumer where this hits them harder. There's also a psychological impact to even the higher end consumers. And we're already seeing that in some of the confidence reads that break down the confidence amongst different income earners. And the top 20% of income earners spend about 40% of the money in terms of retail sales. So even their confidence is getting shaken. And then now you throw in what's going on in the markets, and that can also shake the confidence of higher end spending as well. And then, of course, just doing business has become that much more challenging, whether it is trying to get employees for a restaurant, whether it's a restaurant that now has to pay wages that needs to compete against Costco and Amazon, that becomes more expensive, that then squeezes margins. If you are a retailer that gets stuff from overseas, and you know, while the ports of LA have eased up a little bit, they're now, you know, adding up on ports on the East Coast. So just everything is more difficult in terms of doing business because of these supply chain and labor issues, that the net result is a slowdown in activity. It's just only natural. It's not really being profound here. But the question is to what rate of growth do we slow to? Is it a small positive? Is it a flat line? Or is there a minus sign in front? I think the answer to any of that will still feel the same. We're going to see a dramatic slowing of growth at the same time the Fed is raising interest rates. And then, as I mentioned, you throw in a decline in asset prices, and that can very easily impact the psyche of higher end spenders, which make up a big chunk of retail spending.
All right. And I want to talk about the throw in, you know, lower asset prices in just a moment too, to see how you think a further market correction could exacerbate, you know, the slowing economic pain that we're referring to here. It is interesting. So I just, as you were talking, I just peeked at the latest Atlanta Fed GDP Now numbers. So last week they were at zero in terms of the projected GDP for Q1. And as you know, we're sort of referencing what it was in Q4, it's up near seven, it was market deceleration, right? It's bounced up a tiny bit now to 0.5. But generally that number tends to trend lower anyways, but let's even leave it at 0.5% for Q1. It doesn't have much further to go before that begins to become negative. So if we're thinking about, hey, if these, you know, supply chain issues are going to persist, if inflation is going to continue to rage for a while, if the Fed is now going to start tightening interest rates, you know, the cost of capital is going to start getting more expensive. You mentioned the sentiment numbers are deteriorating. It's pretty easy to imagine that things will go a bit lower from here. And again, 0.5% is not very high. So it really wouldn't take all that much to tip us negative. And then, of course, two quarters in a row is the textbook definition for a recession. Let me ask you this. If you think it's more likely that we are going to continue slowing from here, how bad do you think it's likely to get? You know, if we do go into recession, do you see it being run-of-the-mill one, or do you think it being worse than that because of, I mean, one, it's been a long time since we've had one, but a lot of the uncertainty that I mentioned in the intro, you know, that's still swirling around out there. I presume that could maybe make things potentially a lot worse from here.
Well, to be fair, that 0.5% estimate is off the tough comparison of 7% in Q4. So the question is, how does the economy immediately responding to the invasion and the spike in commodity prices and also we now have China that's shutting down cities like Shenzhen of 17.5 million people and the mud that throws into the gears of business and supply chains that will mostly show up in Q2. So
Peter, sorry to interrupt you, but I was going to ask you about this, but I just want to make sure people understand what you're referring to there. So sadly, even though we'd all love to just completely forget about COVID, COVID cases are beginning to spike back up in Asian countries. In Hong Kong, they've just totally gone exponential. Same in South Korea. And China is now basically putting Shenzhen, and I can't remember the name of the other province, but some of its provinces that are sort of leading in, you know, manufacturing, back into lockdown. Tens of millions of people, you know, basically back getting under lockdown again. So it's exacerbating, re-exacerbating some of these supply chain shortages that we've been seeing. So sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted people to understand the context for why you were citing China there.
Right. And it's the sort of the unintended consequence of the approach that China has taken, in that they decided to take the zero COVID approach, which meant that there would be less immunity built up among its populace, as opposed to the US and Europe, which have very high levels of immunity, whether vaccine-based or natural. And now they're paying the consequence. Luckily, the Omicron, which is the variant that they're obviously dealing with, is not more lethal. And if anything, the higher contagious nature of it will speed up the process of immunizing the people there. But in the meantime, it's again mucking up the delivery of goods, and you have production lines that are getting shut down, and how that's just going to create even more issues with supply chains, which then enhances and exaggerates the inflation story, forces central banks to raise interest rates into a slowing economy. So when you ask about, is this going to be just a run of the mill? You have to understand that every recession previous to this has been met with a bout of monetary easing. And also to separate the previous recessions. So pre-COVID, the prior two recessions, housing and the tech bubble, were really driven by a decline in asset prices. Tech stocks fall, we had a collapse in capital spending, housing prices fall, we have a collapse in bank balance sheets because of the collateral being housing falling in value. This time around, it could be a combination of fall in asset prices, but also a decline in activity. At the same time, we can't expect the Fed and other central banks to come around and save the day. After the tech bubble burst, we know Greenspan cut rates to 1%. We know how the Fed responded to the housing bubble with QE and cheap money. We know after COVID, the Fed had about 200 plus basis points. Actually, it was less than that because they started cutting pre-COVID, but they had basis points to cut. They had balance sheet room to maneuver in terms of expansion.
And they had a mild inflation environment too.
And they had the mild inflation environment. So there is no room for flexibility with respect to the Fed and other central banks' ability to confront an economic recession. And in a way, that's a good thing, in the sense of letting the economy run through itself without having the artificial lift. But on the other hand, it could mean that we don't get that quick snapback that so many people are used to, whether that's an actual economic activity or it's the V bottoms that market participants have been so accustomed to, saved by the bell by the Fed.
All right. Well, look, I've got a number of questions I still want to ask that are sort of relevant to these factors that could make things worse, but kind of a higher level question beforehand, which is, you know, the role of the Federal Reserve for much of this new millennium has been really trying to strangle natural market cycles, right? I mean, we used to kind of have this boom bust, right, business cycle, right? And the Feds, for whatever reason, sort of seemed to you know, take on the mandate of saying, you know what, we're just going to try to have sort of perpetual prosperity. We just want the boom all the time. We don't want any of the bust. And, you know, people have drawn all sorts of analogies about, you know, preventing forest fires and then getting the forest to a state where it's just so, you know, flammable that the first wanton spark just sets off a conflagration that would have been way worse if you had let the forest burn naturally over the years. We can pick whatever analogy you want. But do you sense that we are sort of maybe finally having to sort of pay the piper here for several decades of trying to deny reality on the central planning side?
I think it's very possible. And just to add, you know, more color to what you just said, is that when Greenspan was Fed chair and he really prioritized asset prices and this whole wealth effect concept, and he sort of reversed the idea of stock prices reflect expectations about the economy and earnings to asset prices driving the economy and earnings. And what that meant was we turned normal economic business cycles into credit cycles as we ebb and flow now with the cost of capital and the ability to borrow. So now when you think about where rates are today, what is the ability to borrow going forward in terms of stimulation to the economy? Because that's what monetary policy is meant to do, is to stimulate activity today that would have happened tomorrow. By encouraging you to borrow today via low interest rates rather than saving and maybe borrowing at a higher rate, but later on. So look at Japan. Japan has reduced the urgency to take advantage of low interest rates because low interest rates are low forever. So there's no sense of urgency to act now. You can just wait. Whereas now we are running into that same situation where we are losing the effectiveness of low interest rates if they're low forever. And that, if anything, you actually start to get restrictive monetary policy because let's break out the US economy between small, medium, and large businesses. Large companies have access to the capital markets. They feast on a low interest rate type of environment, and they get access to the capital markets, and they can borrow money cheaply for many years. Small and medium-sized businesses still have to rely on conventional bank loans. Well, if you lower and cut the profit margin on a loan via low interest rates, well, you disincentivize the ability of banks to lend. And if they do lend, they're going to have to be tighter with their standards because they're doing this at a lower margin. So good luck going to get a bank loan now without having to put a personal guarantee down, without having to run through a lot of different hoops just to get a bank loan, whereas a big company can snap their finger and get financed. That then has economic implications. It creates the haves and the have-nots. And if anything, you know, sort of neuters the ability of low interest rates to stimulate economic activity.
All right. Well, then, again, I'll get into the details in just a minute, but staying up here at a high level, I think there's no small percentage of viewers of this channel who, you know, agree with you and have said, you know what, we've just sort of deformed, distorted, perverted the system in a way that's created all sorts of long-term baggage that we don't want to have, and all this this wealth inequality that you just cited there, where they're almost kind of rooting for a clearing event where, yeah, it's going to hurt and we need to take the medicine that we need to, you know, operate things from a saner baseline going forward. You know, could that sort of be the silver lining coming out of a very painful recession that we might be going into here, where it finally clears out a lot of the malinvestment and maybe, you know, maybe the pain forces some of our elected leaders to say, gosh, you know what, the rules we were playing by beforehand didn't really end up so well for us. Maybe we should be a little bit more prudent going forward. Well, or am I just being a Pollyanna here?
Well, no, we may get we have to differentiate here. We may get a clearing event in terms of the value of assets, which is another way of saying they may re-rate much lower. And investors would be then more discriminating in who they lend money to or what stock they buy. And that paying 30, 40, 50 times sales for a company is probably not a good idea. But, you know, part of that clearing event in order to make that healthy is also a rethink in monetary policy.
Right.
If it's the monetary policy that created the inflation in asset prices, If that doesn't change, then you, if that, that sort of approach to monetary policy doesn't change, then you don't get a full clearing of that. And as long as the Fed is made up of conventional monetary modern day thinkers, where they think low rates are good, high rates are bad, and QE is good and QE and not QE is not good, well, then you're really not going to have the real clearing effect, because you can be sure at some point in this economic downturn or this market downturn that the Fed will most likely revert back to QE and probably cut rates back to zero.
Well, and I was going to ask you that, so I'm glad you're going there. So run with that. So the all their tough talk, you think there's a pain point at which they're just going to reverse it all?
Well, they will reach that fork in the road where you have the markets down a bunch, credit spreads widening a lot, growth even with a minus sign, but inflation is still running 4 or 5%. Mm-hmm. And if they kowtow to the markets and say, we need to save the economy by cutting rates and initiating QE, well, then that does that exaggerate the inflation? Does that sacrifice the US dollar, which then creates its own problem? Or are they going to say, you know what, we need the cleansing event. Zero interest rates is not a good idea. Having our balance sheet at $9 trillion is not a good idea. And you know what, let's just wait and let's let the market clear on its own. Let's let the economy de-lever and wash through this and have the cleansing event that we all hope for. Well, unless you get a change in Fed regime and Fed thinking, I just don't see that happening. And in that fork, the Fed will most likely try to save the S&P 500 and try to save the economy, but at the risk of creating more inflation, which then will not save the economy. You need stable prices in order to have a healthy economy. And we know Jay Powell has repeated the exact mistakes of the 1970s, where they are prioritized employment and not stable prices. And look what the end result was. It took a Paul Volcker to slow the economy and bite the bullet to lower the rate of inflation which caused a recession in order to create a healthier baseline. This Fed will be afraid to do that.
Well, I don't disagree with you. And it's interesting, Jay Powell was, you know, so the Fed chair is placed into office by the president. He was put in place by a Republican president. It looks like he's been reaffirmed by a Democratic president. So my point there is I don't know whoever's sitting in the seat right now, given the talent pool we have, is going to choose anybody different unless they absolutely have to. And I was talking with Lacey Hunt not that long ago about Paul Volcker, whom he knew. And he said, hey, you got to remember, like Volcker was put in there with this mandate. He was the last chance. So in other words, they had a couple other Fed chairs who tried all sorts of different things that didn't work. And they finally just said, look, you know what, we're going to have to resort to the really tough medicine. And Paul, you got to go in there and do it. So I just wonder if history is going to repeat like this, which is whether Biden picks a different horse eventually, or whether whoever succeeds Biden picks somebody else, are they going to pick folks who are going to try all sorts of other things besides what we really need and only get to that tough medicine kicking and dragging because everything else has failed?
Well, the problem this time around relative to the 1970s was what I like to call the conjoined triplet syndrome of monetary policy, markets, and the economy. Whereas in the 1970s, the markets were sort of an afterthought. It was growth, it was inflation, and interest rates intertwined with that. Now, monetary policy is not just targeting the economy, it's also targeting financial conditions, AKA asset prices. So when you talk about tough medicine, it's not just slowing growth, it's a notable recheck lower in valuations of a lot of different things that then also obviously ties into the economy, which makes...
And sorry, just to add to it, it's also job losses. I mean, you have to basically tell people, look, we know you're losing your jobs over this, but we have to let this clear, which of course no politician ever wants to have to say.
That's exactly right. It's short-term-ism thinking that particularly nowadays, no politician will reside over. I mean, there's one thing to say, yes, I know you don't like paying higher gasoline prices, but are you willing to risk losing your job over it? Because I need to raise interest rates to a point that's going to lower your demand for that gallon of gasoline, but slow economic growth and watch unemployment go higher. I mean, there are just a lot of bad choices out there. And to your, you know, one of your points about is what we're seeing sort of a culmination of many years of bad policy that has resulted in so many excesses and so many distortions that are we now going to have to pay the piper for this? And unfortunately, it might end up being the case with only the degree of pain being the question.
All right. I like that summarization. I shouldn't say I like it because it's a lot of unpleasantness that will come out of it. But yeah, it's just a matter of how much the pain is going to be. All right. So I want to get to some questions about, you know, this. At the end of the day, this is an investing program. And I'm going to ask you the question, given what you see ahead in your outlook, you know, what would you encourage today's, you know, regular investors to consider in terms of where to place capital, especially if we're looking at potentially, you know, a more substantial correction in the markets and maybe a long-term recession? You know, are there sectors or asset classes that you think would better serve investors versus others? But quickly before we get there, we talked about the rising cost of capital, and I just want to spend a little bit more time talking about, you know, the implications of that, right? And rising cost of capital, at least in theory, means that financial asset prices have to come down. You just have less profit left over if your capital costs go up. The problem is we have a lot of we have a system that is geared now towards these historically low interest rates that we've had. And it may not be able to tolerate interest rates going up very much. Probably an extreme example of that is, you know, I hear different terms getting bandied about, but about 20% of corporate America are zombie corporations, right? Are companies that basically have to borrow to meet their financing costs, right? And that borrowing costs go up above a certain level, those companies just go insolvent super quickly. But even just hitting home to more sort of regular people, mortgage rates are beginning to creep up. In fact, from last August, they've increased 49%. I just pulled the numbers. It was like 2.7 something percent last August, and the latest 30-year fixed average was about 3.85%, right? That's a pretty big jump for a lot of people. And with the Fed continuing to raise rates and whatnot, and things financial conditions continuing to tighten, you know, mortgage rates could keep going higher. And of course, if we got a Volcker type, you know, in the Fed, they could go bananas, right? So that's where most people tend to have the majority of their wealth in America. So my point to you is how concerned are you about the outlook for the cost of capital from here? I just mentioned a couple of knock-on effects, but is this something that could, you know, trigger some sort of cascade through the system at some point where we get these players who just can't live with these higher rates? They just start, you know, domino effecting, collapsing.
Well, as we've seen over the past few decades, each rate hiking cycle ends at a lower peak than the previous one, and that is because of the ever-growing sensitivity to the cost of capital, and to my point I made earlier, that we now have credit cycles that ebb and flow with the cost of capital, and that with all the debt that has accumulated, we are very sensitive to small changes in interest rates. So you mentioned housing, for example. It took only a small increase in mortgage rates to see a very sharp decline in refinancing. We've seen low interest rates result in almost 20% year-over-year increase in home prices. But if we now get a rise in mortgage rates, the positive spin is that we may actually see a slowdown in the rate of home price increases. But in terms of this whole edifice that we call the global economy, it does sit on a foundation of very low interest rates and very low inflation. We now have very high inflation and rising interest rates that create obviously potential problems across the board. Especially the setup going into this rise in interest rates is we've had historically high multiples on stocks in certain areas of the market, and we've had historically tight credit spreads. So even with this backup in interest rates, you've seen the high yield market, which is now selling off and spreads are now widening, they're still relatively low, which means that there's further weakness ahead, which then could obviously impact companies that are trying to raise capital. And it's beginning to happen. If you talk to a venture capitalist, they'll admit that they're being more stringent in terms of the investments that they're giving out. The capital markets are certainly a lot more stringent in the money that they're going to lend out. The amount of debt issuance has slowed. The IPO and SPAC world, well, that slowed dramatically. Good luck trying to price an IPO in this kind of a market. So there has been an immediate economic fundraising impact. A fundraising impact that then impacts the economy. But yeah, that overall, you get a sharp rise in interest rates in a highly indebted economy. That is certainly a cause for concern. And the question is at what level of interest rates does that pain occur? And a lot of times is we don't know until we get there. But like I said earlier, typically it's at a lower interest rate than the previous cycle that causes the indigestion. I mean, look, it was a 2.25%, 2.5% Fed funds rate at the same time that Powell was shrinking the balance sheet that caused a 20% decline in the stock market in the fourth quarter of 2018 that broke things. So we have to assume that it'll be a much lower Fed funds rate that causes a lot of indigestion and that we never get back to the level that we saw then in terms of the Fed funds rate.
Yeah, and probably a big factor of that is all the debt, you know, at each point along the timeline there in history, the debt that we've had has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, right?
Well, yeah, look at the U.S. government that has $30 trillion of debt. So every 100 basis points, that's an extra $300 billion of interest expense. Well, I think the total defense budget is maybe $500 to $600 billion. So we're talking about real pain for the financing of the U.S. government. And now that the Fed is no longer buying treasuries, and if they reach a point where in terms of net purchases, if they then start shrinking the balance sheet, we need to find some more buyers for our treasuries. And to tie that into your introduction about weaponizing the dollar, well, are we going to have foreigners that are going to increase the pace of U.S. treasury purchases? Probably not. Are we going to have banks that are going to have to start buying more U.S. treasuries? Well, maybe. And if they do, that means less lending to the private economy. So there are a host of challenges that come from higher interest rates.
Yeah, I mean, it really does just seem like we're having this collection brewing into a perfect storm here. And one of the things that I want to try to just make sure people are aware of, and I mentioned it briefly earlier, but is... if we go back into recession, and if it's a moderate to more severe type of recession, we'll go back to job losses. And what's so interesting to me is we've since 2008, it's been pretty clear sailing. It was punctuated by what happened during COVID, but that was really the shortest lived economic period of pain that we probably ever had in this country's history. You know, a lot of people lost their jobs, they were given lots of stimulus along the way, records amount of stimulus. And, it wasn't that long before we ended up in, what's the term for it here? The Great Resignation, right? Where all of a sudden, people have become incredibly picky and choosy about if they want to go back to work and under what conditions they want to go back to work. And we've seen headlines over the past year of all the companies that are struggling to get workers. And of course, that's raised lots of questions about wage price inflation and whatnot. But if we go into a pretty stiff recession, particularly if it's a prolonged one, which given all the factors you and I are talking about, I think odds aren't bad that it could last for a fair while. We could really see something much more like 2008, where people could be losing jobs, out of work for a year, 2 years plus, whatever, which is just something I don't think many people have in their psyche right now. And given this great resignation, we had a records amount of people retiring early, right? Because their financial portfolios were up. They had sort of sailed through, you know, they'd done very well over the past 10 years, but all the stimulus that got thrown into the system spiked the markets a lot higher. And they said, oh gosh, you know what? I can retire years early now. I wonder, and I put out sort of a snarky tweet about this yesterday, when Tom Brady announced that he was unretiring and coming back to play at Tampa Bay. I think unretiring is going to be a trend that we hear an awful lot about if we indeed have this, you know, market correction, then recession that you're talking about. And so one of the reasons I just want to underscore this is to help people get in the mindset of, hey, if this indeed does happen, what steps can I take today to make myself maybe a little bit less vulnerable? Do you share my concern here about sort of just the general American populace's level of unpreparedness for the type of recession that you think might be coming?
Well, I would say, firstly, unprepared in terms of the level of savings. Certainly, the government threw a lot of money at people over the last couple of years, and that did elevate the savings rate. We've since come back to sort of pre-COVID levels. Now, there's still this supply-demand imbalance in terms of labor. There's still more demand relative to the supply. So we'll obviously have to watch how the labor market responds to any economic slowdown, because you can still see people with still having jobs, but economic growth can still slow a lot. So I'm still uncertain at how the labor market will respond to this next downturn. To your point about unretiring, a stock we own for clients and I own for myself is a company called ABM Industries, and they provide outsourced services like janitorial services to universities and healthcare facilities and aviation and airports and so on. It's a very labor-intensive business. They have 140,000 employees. And in the conference call they had early last week, the CEO speculated that they're seeing more job applicants. And he speculated that maybe that is because the rise in inflation, the rise in one's cost of living, is forcing people that decided not to be in the labor force for whatever reason, health reasons, generous government transfer payments, retirement, wherever, that actually more people are coming in because this rise in their cost of living, they need to get a job. They need to supplement their income with a job. So I do think that, yes, people will be forced to come back, whether that is because of higher gas prices or lower stock portfolios, you can very well see more demand for jobs because of those reasons. Now, to what extent and how this all plays out, I don't like to make too many forecasts going out because I'm trying to game this out step by step. And since this is sort of a different economic cycle than we're used to, in the sense that the Fed, which typically is raising interest rates in maybe the third inning or fourth inning of an economic recovery, is doing it like in the eighth inning. There are just so many moving parts here that we have to watch. And it's really tough to forecast.
All right. Well, I appreciate you speculating, and I know I'm sort of pushing you to do that here. I really appreciate that anecdote about ABM. That's sort of exactly what I've been expecting to see as the stimulus payments dried up last year. The Fed is stopping monetary stimulus. The Congress can't seem to get any more fiscal stimulus out the door. And now inflation has taken off, right? You just would sadly expect households to get squeezed from that. And then, you know, we've seen a 12% correction or so in the markets so far. It's probably something that's got retirees, it's now maybe got their attention a little bit, but I don't think they're necessarily really that worried at this stage. But if we were to tip over into, you know, a very serious market correction of the type that you and I are talking about could happen, given all of this, that really could be a game changer. And one other just quick anecdote I heard, a colleague of mine, he writes a lot of economic analysis. He derives a fair amount of his support from Patreon, which is a service where people basically just, you know, they sign up to give money on a regular basis to content producers whom they like and want to have stick around. And I've always talked to them about the fact that Patreon could be a real canary in the coal mine for how, you know, the average US household is doing, because it's not an essential expense. It's kind of a nice to have expense that you're giving, you know, just sort of philanthropically. And my, you know, thesis has always been, when household budgets start getting tight, that's going to be one of the first subscriptions that gets cut. And interestingly, it's remained strong year after year after year after year, even through COVID. But now is the first time that he's beginning to see retracements in giving, and not just in his Patreon account, but that of others. The Patreon pie, for whatever reason in the near term, has started to shrink. Now, maybe that's a blip, maybe it's not, but it could be an interesting sort of similar indicator to your ABM example there. All right. Well, look, Peter, I'm going to have you back on again at some point in the future, because there's just, I feel like there's a zillion questions on a number of other topics I just would love to hear your insights on. But let's now dial into the investing side of things. So we've just talked about the whole, you know, perfect storm of risks that's brewing out there. You're somebody that has to figure out how to allocate capital in this type of environment. What type of sectors are you looking at? What type of asset classes are you looking at? How do you think investors can try to chart a relatively, you know, I'm going to say safe, even though it's a risky environment out there, but how can they chart sort of the safer courses possible through the storm we're talking about?
Well, I'll start by talking high level, and then I'll drill it down with specific ideas. The New York Stock Exchange is the only place where the more expensive things get, the more excited people get. And the cheaper things get, the more afraid people get. And that if Walmart said everyday high prices instead of everyday low prices, no one would show up. And that they're one of the biggest employers in the country because of everyday low prices. So what my point is that for those with a long-term time horizon, you'd rather be buying things in a bear market, you'd rather be buying things down than having to buy up, pay higher and higher valuations in a bull market. So I just want to put that out there first. Now, that said, obviously bear markets are painful, and how best do you maneuver through? I've been beginning in September, October 2020, I've been bullish on commodities, believing that they were so undervalued that once we got a successful vaccine, now I had no idea it was going to be, you know, as efficacious as it was in terms of its efficacy rate, but that and an eventual reopening of the economy, that was going to lead to higher commodity prices. I didn't necessarily know where it was going to go, but I do think that rally still has legs to go, but is more difficult from here. Obviously, the Russian invasion has added more supply side issues on the commodity space, adding to the bull case. But if we're going to see a slowdown in economic growth this year, that will then result in lower demand. I think the net result of what I'm trying to say here is that I'm still bullish on commodities and commodity stocks, but just more uncertain about where they go from here. And that said, certain energy stocks, are still below where they were pre-COVID. They have not priced in these very high levels of crude oil and natural gas. So I'm still very bullish on oil stocks. I have been very bullish on fertilizer stocks as a play on agriculture, but I'm a little less bullish just because fertilizer prices are up so much, and that I'm more worried about the demand destruction that they may create. The fundamentals are still very good. Obviously, the supply issues out of Ukraine and Russia are just going to lead to more demand for other options for wheat and corn and soybeans outside of that area, which means that those crop prices will remain very high, but you're going to have a lot of acreage that's not going to get planted in Ukraine, for example. That means less fertilizer. And I'm not sure yet how the American farmer and the Brazilian farmer and the Argentinian farmer are going to respond to very high fertilizer prices. I'm still very bullish on gold and silver. I think that you do have very negative real interest rates. To your point earlier about de-dollarization, that I think will only increase the demand for gold as central banks diversify their their reserve base. The sell-off that we're seeing in Asian markets, I believe, is a buying opportunity when I look out over the next 10 years. To me, the exciting global growth story is the rising middle class in Asia. And it's not just China, it's India, it's Indonesia, and the growing wealth that is going to be created in that side of the world, to me, will help those stock markets that are still very cheap, have dramatically underperformed US markets when looking out over the past 10 years. And lastly, if we look at fixed income, which has become a minefield, which is something that investors are not used to. They're used to their bond portfolio doing well if their equity portfolio is not. And that's why we have a new investing landscape where both are selling off. But if you are looking for an area of fixed income that I think could work in this environment, and it is local currency emerging market bonds. It's the bonds of Brazil, where their Selic rate, their overnight interest rate, will likely be 11.75% by the end of the week after they raise by another 100 basis points. And this commodity upswing is helping the Brazilian economy and the Brazilian real. So I do think that there are opportunities in emerging markets where you are taking sovereign risk, which is obviously less than corporate risk, assuming obviously you're not in Russian bonds, and you can get 5 to 6% yields, and you can possibly, and just if the dollar just stops rallying against some of these commodity currencies, and if the dollar weakens, you can get a currency kicker there as well. So those are just some ideas. There's still plenty of value names out there, but I think time horizon is going to be key here. You really have to extend your time horizon out. And if you don't have that time horizon, if you got a big expense to pay for, if you have a wedding, if you have college to pay for, cash is king right now. And even if you lose money on a real basis, cash will lose you nothing on a nominal basis.
All right. Well, Peter, that was a phenomenal answer. That is exactly the type of answer the folks that view these videos are hoping that our guests will give. So thank you for being so concrete. Let me just do a quick summarization, and then I have a question for you. It sounds like cash is a very viable position to be in right now. You sort of started your answer by saying, look, if you expect things to enter a bear market, they will be cheaper tomorrow. And if you can afford to wait, you know, just building some cash and being prepared at a later date to deploy it at more attractive valuations is a pretty good strategy. You went through all the reasons why you're still bullish commodities. Certain sectors, though, you think are getting a little rich. If we have enough demand destruction, if prices get too high, you know, that might bring demand down for those. So what I sort of heard you say was, they're still attractive, but just proceed with caution. You know, be very mindful about why you're buying, what you're buying, and have an exit strategy. You talked about emerging markets. Then you talked about fixed income, and you talked about local currency emerging market bonds. How can the regular investor buy those?
There are mutual funds out there. There are ETFs out there. Now, there are emerging market sovereign bond funds that are out there. There are dollar denominated ones and there are local currency denominated ones. So you can buy either or. I prefer the local currency right now, but there are ETFs out there that that investors can buy. There are mutual funds out there that focus on that as well.
Okay. And is the main reason you prefer the local currency ones because you expect the US dollar to weaken weaken over time?
Well, it's two things. Yes, I do expect it to weaken over time, but I also like some of those commodity currency countries, like I mentioned, Brazil. Even South Africa is a beneficiary in this kind of environment, with the price of palladium higher and the price of other important metals higher. So I do think that that will actually benefit those currencies. And plus, these central banks, emerging market central banks, have been much more aggressive than developed country central banks in raising interest rates because of their experience with inflation. I mentioned the Brazilian central bank that is on the cusp of raising interest rates by another 100 basis points to 11.75%. This base rate was about 2 just a few years ago. So because of the scars on their back they've gotten historically from inflation, they were very quick to take away the emergency policy. So it's ironic that a lot of these emerging market central banks have been much more responsible in guiding monetary policy relative to the developed world.
Right. Well, to your point, they're just more experienced in fighting inflation. Yeah, they've had to do that a lot recently. A lot of those South American countries, where here at the U.S., we've honestly, you know, kind of forgotten about it. You know, they always say you fight the last battle, and you know, Fed chairs from Bernanke on have been, you know, so afraid of the Great Depression that they've just taken their eye off the inflation genie. You can make a pretty good argument, you know, at the central bank level, that we don't have people that are good inflation fighters. And you can make, I think, a really good argument that we don't have many investors left who have real world experience investing in an inflationary environment, at least not in the developed world. So yeah, we can learn something from these emerging markets.
Right. You're exactly right. I would say that most people were not investing in the 1970s, and you were either not alive, you were myself watching cartoons, or you know, the others that were investing, but there are much less of them relative to the rest of us.
All right. Well, one asset I didn't hear you mention was U.S. Treasuries, which, you know, I'd say a number of our other guest experts on this program who have expected that we're going to be heading back into recession, and, you know, probably wide scale market correction being somewhere in the mix too, have said, okay, flight to safety. You know, wouldn't touch a lot of other types of debt, but, you know, long dated U.S. sovereign debt, you would expect to be the gold standard along with gold as a flight to safety asset, and that demand would drive interest rates down for long dated U.S. treasuries and prices up. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm actually very comfortable owning short term treasuries, certainly not long term treasuries. And I think one of the dynamics that some are not appreciating, some of the bulls out there on longer term treasuries are not appreciating, is the influence of the European bond market on our treasury market. In that, when you look at where was the real sort of gist of this financial bubble over the past bunch of years, and it really was, in my opinion, the European bond market, where you had negative interest rates. Mm-hmm. And negative interest rates is sort of the epitome of a bubble, because you're turning what was once an asset, that being a bond that paid you a coupon and your principal back, turned it into a liability, because owning that bond cost you money. And it was the ultimate hot potato. And I think that that's sort of what I call poison of negative interest rates filtered into a lot of different things in terms of inflating asset prices. And now you have the air coming out of that bond bubble. And that will then filter into the US bond market and other bond markets. And that you can analyze the US inflation rate and your expectations for inflation as much as you want. But if you're not paying attention to where the German 10-year bund yield is going, I think you're not fully analyzing where US treasuries could go. And the problem right now, even putting that aside, with US treasuries is, while you may think they're a flight to safety here, in light of a war, for example, that's causing geopolitical concerns. Well, I refer to buying treasuries now, longer-term treasuries, as sort of quicksand, because people are jumping into it thinking that it's safe ground, but you're slowly falling in terms of inflation eating up your return. And the U.S. 10-year yield was 192, 193 the day before Russia invaded, and now we're approaching 215. So no flight to safety because of that inflation catch, and because of the sell-off that we're seeing, which is rather dramatic in the European bond market. I mean, the German 10-year bund yield at the lows was minus 65 basis points. Now it's about plus 35 basis points. Mm-hmm. That's quite a reversal. And if the European Central Bank by year end gets to just zero interest rates, that would clip about another $4 trillion worth of bonds that are yielding less than zero, which means that longer term interest rates are likely headed higher, even with a global economic slowdown.
Okay. Well, fascinating. So last question for you. You mentioned that you're pretty bullish on the precious metals. A conversation that I've had with several people recently is, talking about bonds is if you hold bonds in your portfolio, as many capital managers do, large institutional capital managers do, and you're looking at these low interest rates, even if they're rising a bit, they're still quite low historically. And then you compare them to the inflation rate, these guys are just looking at, you know, negative real returns for as long as they can see. Is that bullish for the precious metals because you get the safe haven protection without the negative yield?
In a word, yes. We have negative real interest rates that are greater than where we stood in the 1970s when you just look at CPI relative to the Fed funds rate. And even if the US bond market is right, and we get the Fed, and the Fed gets the Fed funds rate to 1.5% by year end, that will still be dramatically below the rate of inflation, which on a rate of change basis will slow as the year progresses for the sole reason that the comparisons get very difficult. But even with that moderation in the rate of change, real interest rates will remain deeply negative, which is a great bull foundation for precious metals.
So let me just ask you this then. So, you know, I think of the tremendous amount of money that's in the bond market. And I hear different estimates of the size, but if you have a good one, please just toss it out there. I know the gold market is more like around 7 or 8 trillion, I think I've heard tossed out there, but a good chunk of that, you know, is held in central bank vaults, right? So it's not available for purchase. So I think about, okay, there's a lot of smart bond investors out there that have come to this conclusion. Because the bond market's so much larger, you know, if even just a small slice of that moves its way over into the addressable gold market, you know, it's going to like double the size of that market overnight. So I'm just wondering why gold prices haven't already responded to this, because this seems like, I don't want to say an inevitability, but the logic seems pretty sound. And I can't imagine that some percentage of people holding on to bonds aren't going to do this.
They will. I mean, I'm at a wealth management firm. We have 50 plus advisors, and I'm already seeing it about investors being realistic of what their bond portfolio potentially could deliver. And not a bad thing to have some gold and silver, with obviously my encouragement to them, instead of having fixed income. So the size of the global bond market, I mean, it's in the hundreds of trillions. So the $10 trillion sliver, or 8 to 10 trillion of gold is obviously very minuscule. And as a percent of total financial assets, it's a fraction of where it stood in the 1970s when gold went from $35 to $850 an ounce. So you will see that. Now, in terms of the price of gold, yeah, we can all say, how come it's not much higher? But putting things in perspective, it was just a week ago that it was at a 5,000-year high.
That is true. That is true. We did hit an intraday all-time high. All right. Well, look, I'm going to have to wrap this up, but just curious, if this were to happen, right, if some percentage, and I'll let you decide what percentage of bonds make their way over into the gold market, how high do you think gold could go?
So that's a question I get a lot, and it's obviously impossible to say for sure. But if you inflation adjust the price of gold, if you think that the price of gold should reflect the size of central bank balance sheets, historically speaking, as a percent, it can go to 3,000, it can go to 5,000, it can go to 10,000. I don't think any of those numbers are crazy talk.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up at that. So, Peter, for folks who have really enjoyed this discussion, as I have, I'm really glad that we've had you come on here, and I really hope we can have you come on again in the future. Sure. Where can people go to follow you and your work?
Well, if they want to see my daily commentary, they can subscribe to my work at bookreport.com. That's B-O-O-C-K, report.com. And if they're interested in learning more about our wealth management services and the type of investments we do, they can go to bleakley.com and reach out.
Fantastic. And when we edit this, I'll put the URL up for those. And you're active on Twitter too, aren't you?
Yes, at PBookFar.
Oh, great, Peter. Well, before we end here, given your strong positive comments about where the gold price could rise to, I want to flag an important free resource for folks. Since gold's been on the move of late and the world is beginning to panic about inflation, the number one question I get asked these days is, if I want to buy some gold and silver, where are trustworthy providers to buy it from, and where are good places to store it? I've mentioned several resources in past videos on this channel, but I figured it'd be most helpful for everyone to just have all my guidance put down in writing. So I've updated my primer on how to buy and store gold and silver, and it's available to everybody right now for free at wealthion.com/how-to-buy. I'll put a link to that page in the description below this video too. But before you go read it, help support this channel in bringing you more top-notch financial experts like Peter Bookvar by hitting the like button and then clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. All right, once you've done that, then now you can go over to wealthion.com/how-to-buy. Peter, thank you so much for delivering such a detail-rich discussion here. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks so much.